Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and today we're going to talk about the economy, something that, while key to President Trump's standing with Americans, we don't usually discuss in a lot of detail on this podcast. And we're going to dig into the United States trade war with China in particular. So to lay out some of the stakes, for much of Trump's presidency, he's remained unpopular nationally with an approval rating consistently around net negative 10. At the same time, Americans have given him significantly better scores on the economy. His approval on the economy has fluctuated in the range of net positive 10. He gets better marks there than on basically any other issue, from foreign affairs to immigration to his personal characteristics as a leader. And we've talked repeatedly about how positive economic news has likely buoyed Trump's approval rating overall. But the economy has shown more volatility lately, and that's in part because of Trump's trade war with China, among other things. So here to talk about how the trade war could play out for Trump and where the economy overall seems to be headed is international economist at Syracuse University, Mary Lovely. She's also a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics. Hello, Mary. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be with you, Galen.
So before we get into exactly how this trade war is affecting the economy, how unprecedented is this? Is it rare for two of the world's biggest economies to go back and forth like this?
Well, you know, they have to dig back to sort of ancient history to come up with the precedent for it. I really don't mean ancient history, but pre-World War II. In the post-World War II era, yes, this is quite unusual. The U.S. has been, in some people's views, the hegemon, but it's clearly been the leader in terms of creating international rules of the road for trade. And what we're seeing now is sort of a mass disruption of the system being carried out by that very same leader, the United States.
What is the goal of Trump's tariffs?
That is a good question, and it's very hard to answer for the following reason. We do have an official justification for the tariffs against China, but we also have many comments and tweets from the president himself that suggest that there are really other goals. The original goals, the goals that are in U.S. law under the Section 301 case, which is what it is, basically say that China has kept us from having the full benefit of our trading relations. It doesn't allege that China has violated any particular agreements that it made under the World Trade Organization. That's not required under the law. Simply has to be that we believe that they're engaging in unfair practices. And the unfair practices revolve mainly around intellectual property, how our multinational companies are treated when they're in the country, how they are treated when they're trying to export into China, into the Chinese market, and also how intellectual property secrets are treated here with allegations of cyber theft of American industrial secrets. So it's a pretty broad case that revolves mainly around intellectual property, unfair technology transfer, and even technology theft.
Is it fair to say that something did need to be done? Because you hear from leaders within both parties and economists talk about Chinese economic practices, including depressing the global price of steel, keeping certain industries closed off to outside companies, intellectual property theft, as you mentioned, currency manipulation, which I know is a whole big question in itself. But how could the United States address these concerns that there's bipartisan agreement on that the country should be addressing?
So there is a lot in this bucket. The U.S. has a whole list of grievances against China. The list has been there for quite some time. We could decompose it and take it, you know, piece by piece. Let's start with the one that we can take off the table, which is currency manipulation. It has come back into the news recently, but by almost any accounting, so basically the U.S. Treasury or mainstream economists, there was some basis for arguing that China was manipulating its currency prior to the global financial crisis. Since then, you know, its intervention has, if anything, been to keep the RMB, their currency, stable. So they're basically not manipulating right now, even though there is a lot of pressure on their currency to fall. Obviously, the president of the United States doesn't want their currency to fall because it will make it easier for them to export, and we're trying to hurt their exports right now. But the global market is saying, you know, we shouldn't be in RMB. We should sell them, and that's tending to push the price down. So basically, the currency manipulation charge was at one time valid. It is no longer valid. That is also the conclusion of the IMF. So the administration is really out on its own here on that one. On the other issues, particularly the intellectual property allegations, there is a lot of evidence that China has been trying to move up the value chains, increase its technological prowess by taking technology from the West. This is not something that hasn't been done in the past. Of course it is. Reverse engineering is probably as old as the wheel. But people feel that it had gotten very aggressive and out of control.
And there are also, of course, complaints about the Chinese government getting overly involved in Chinese industry, particularly steel. We heard plenty about during the 2016 election. We have also heard about China not letting American industries have access to certain parts of the Chinese economy. What kinds of steps could the United States take apart from levying tariffs?
Well, every avenue that's going to succeed is going to be one where we work with our allies. It just makes sense. As long as, you know, China can say, give me your technology or the other guy gets our market, they're going to have leverage. And it has to be, well, go ahead, ask the other guy for his technology. He's not going to give it to you either because his government stands behind. We stand united. So any successful strategy to try to change how China interacts with the international economy, the global economy, is going to have to be one where the advanced countries, the intellectual property producing nations, are united. And Japan and the EU have been trying to engage the United States in this effort. And there has been some movement, but it's slow because the U.S. under President Trump has basically, you know, decided to go it alone with unilateral negotiations, unilateral arm twisting, unilateral threats, unilateral tariffs. So to me, this does not make any sense from a negotiating position, game theoretic position, or anything. We should be going in there saying you really won't have access. Secondly, I think we have to target what it is we're trying to change. Right now, we sort of had this litany of things that look like regime change to the Chinese. You know, saying that you're not going to have state ownership, it's just not going to happen. Other nations are not going to back us up on it. You notice that while many people will say, well, you know, the Japanese are so happy to hear that the United States is taking on China on its intellectual property violations, I can say, yeah, I bet they are, because they're not the ones that are bearing the burden of these huge tariffs. It's the American public. So you're not seeing anyone replicate our, what I would call, sort of senseless approach. Instead, we need to think more in terms of targeting the kinds of interventions we want. So, for example, on electronic vehicles, if the Chinese government is not allowing our producers to import batteries, they have to use domestic batteries, say, we should make it clear that no car with a Chinese battery will be exported to the United States. In other words, you should play tit for tat, and we should make it very clear what the consequences of these types of behaviors should be. This can all be done through negotiation diplomatic channels. It just doesn't make a gigantic splash, you know, and President Trump loves to have the big gesture, right? These are things that I think will take years of negotiation, and we had been doing it. You know, the world was pretty preoccupied with the global financial crisis for a lot of Obama's 2 terms in office. China, in that particular case, was actually helpful in terms of stimulating its economy during the global financial crisis and helping to get the economy moving and keeping the economy going. You know, with China becoming more sophisticated year by year, we see that these issues have come to the fore, and we have to think strategically about how we're going to approach them with our allies.
At this point, how have the United States tariffs and China's retaliations affected both economies?
Well, they're clearly having a slowing effect. The U.S. right now, we say, is slowing but growing. So the GDP growth rate last quarter was recorded at 2.1%. We know China is slowing. It is now below 6%, and there's some doubt as to whether that is actually the true number or whether it's growing more slowly. People are looking carefully at energy usage and other things to try to see what's actually happening. So both economies are slowing. Both are still growing. The question is, what happens next? And in both cases, we have a lot of very serious clouds on the horizon. In the United States, job growth in manufacturing has basically stopped. So that's not a good sign. This was supposed to be a president who was going to use tariffs to create manufacturing jobs, something that I personally would say was always a bad idea, but nevertheless, that was the strategy. So those jobs have stopped growing despite the fact that the tariffs are just really hitting. The second thing is that this is an economy that is basically living on consumer spending, growth in consumer spending. And that can be changed. And the strategy that the president is taking is throwing a lot of uncertainty into the economy. And I think, I've said before, and I think it's true, that once job growth stops, you'll start to see consumers pulling back on their spending, keeping their wallet, and we're already seeing a dramatic softening in auto sales globally, and that's usually a sign that growth in consumer spending is slowing down. You know, once it actually stops, we're going to be in trouble. So I think that it's the uncertainty that's being created here for consumers and for businesses. We've already seen a softening in capital investment, which is, of course, an important source of spending. In China, it's a little different because the Chinese are able to mount these infrastructure projects and keep the mills pumping out steel and cement and other things. And we've seen a lot of softening in their recent reports, except we see a tick up in construction and production of steel and cement, which says they're basically doing this to keep their economy going. So I think we're already seeing the Chinese economy in need of resuscitation to keep that growth going. In the U.S., I think we're at a very difficult point right now.
How likely is it that this current trade dispute in particular sparks a recession in the United States?
Well, I'm not a macroeconomist, but I think personally it's high. We have now had, we're in the longest expansion coming out of the global financial crisis, and I, like almost every other American, would love to see this expansion continue indefinitely. I say that with some personal fervor, since my son will graduate from college next year. And as any parent, I want nothing more than there to be a robust job market for his arrival. But I'm afraid that that will not be the case. I think that, you know, we just have a lot of things that are happening on the global scene. We have Iran, the Iranian sanctions. We have the tech blacklist. We don't know what will happen with technology. We have financial isolation discussions, so taxes on capital inflows into the United States is under discussion in Congress. We have the talk about currency manipulation. We have sanctions, and then, of course, the tariffs. So there's just a ton of things that are going, and we don't need all of them to get worse. We just need a few of them to get worse to slow down job growth or even to create negative increase in jobs, a loss of jobs, and then I think we'll be in trouble.
Yeah, in terms of all that's going on in the economy, plenty of which has nothing to do with the trade war, how large of a role can trade and increasing tariffs and barriers between the two largest economies in the world, how much of a role can that play versus all of the other things which in aggregate seem to be more significant?
You know, this is an important point. It's a very large, diversified economy. There's no reason why the expansion can't continue. In fact, toward the end of 2017, we're in a situation where most countries in the world were expanding simultaneously. That really doesn't happen that often. And we had this chance for this sort of really nice period of the global economy expanding and job creation in virtually every country. So there's no real reason why this has to end. But we see this policymaking, and you can ask, well, is the international or the external sector that important? And in some sense, it isn't. Exports have become a more important part of the U.S. economy, as have imports, but they're still a relatively small share of the economy. This is a very large, diversified economy, as I said, as is China. However, it does affect key sectors quite keenly. So, you know, we see that President Trump has been willing to threaten tariffs and perhaps import quotas on automobiles. Automobiles is a huge sector. And it's a sector that's undergoing very rapid technological change. So instead of sort of throwing more, you know, dust into the wind, it's really a sector where we should be thinking about how are we going to make this move. When we look at tech, we see the same thing. Tech's been a huge sector. It's been a growth sector. It's very important in terms of productivity improvements in all sectors, education, government, everybody. Healthcare, we know we still have a long way to go in terms of getting IT to deliver on the promises of reducing costs in the health sector. And yet, what are we doing here? We're having a lot of conversations about whether we should be taxing all of the computers and devices that come from China with 10 or 25% tariff. In Europe, we're facing a digital tax. So, you know, basically, the external sector, I think, given the types of policies that are being pursued, sort of what the economist calls the use of weapons of mass disruption, will actually have a large effect in this case.
All right. I want to continue this conversation in just a moment. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by Honey. Have you ever bought something online only to find out later that you missed a discount? Well, you don't have to overspend anymore thanks to Honey. Honey is a free browser add-on that finds you the best deals online. The app magically auto-applies the best deal to your cart at checkout. Honey finds discounts and coupons across 37,000 sites. Amazon, Sephora, Best Buy, Nordstrom, and more. With Honey, you don't have to worry about missing a deal. Just shop like normal, and Honey handles the rest. Honey has over 100,000 five-star reviews on the Google Chrome Store, and Time Magazine calls it basically free money. There's really no reason not to use Honey. It's free to use and easy to install on your computer in just two clicks. So shop with confidence. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/538. That's joinhoney.com/538. All right, we're back and picking up on the current trade dispute. Trump infamously said that trade wars are, quote, good and easy to win. Now, in the abstract, not necessarily pertaining to this situation, what does it take to win a trade war?
To win a trade war, you have to be a large country, and you're basically manipulating the terms of trade in your favor. So you're basically trying to get the stuff you buy more cheaply relative to the stuff you sell. When we have two large countries, as we do with U.S. and China, there could very well be no winner. In fact, both players could be worse off. So, you know, it's a situation where the economics tells us that this is not, you know, this trade war is not going to end well for either party. And there's probably a better way to do this.
The argument that I've heard is from Trump himself, of course, is that because we import so much more from China than they import from us, it would be easier for the U.S. to inflict more damage on the Chinese economy in a trade war. Is that the case?
I would argue no. I mean, on the face of it, the answer is obviously yes. The numbers are such that it's clear that we import more from them than they import from us. But that doesn't take into account the huge volume of sales that our multinationals do inside China, which almost equals out the balance. And
so
they
how exactly does that play out?
So we have, say, Kentucky Fried Chicken. We have Apple Corporation. We have Micron. We have Intel. You know, we have a lot of companies, Procter & Gamble, huge sales, General Electric. These are all companies that are doing business in China. They are exporting some inputs to China and then producing inside China for sales to the Chinese economy. And China has, you know, there's some reports that they've been hassled a bit, but largely they've been untouched. So I think there's a lot of American assets and sales in China that are potentially at risk. I don't think China will do it. I think China has taken great pains to remain open for business. It is trying to isolate this dispute with the United States from its relations with the rest of the world and continue to be a place to host foreign investment from the rest of the world. And so far, that seems to be consistent with their behavior. So I think that he's only looking at one part of the overall relationship.
I mean, in theory, right, you win a trade war eventually by being able to take the retaliations and the back and forth and not be the first person to cry uncle. how do we see this potentially playing out? Is there a point at which we could see China crying uncle? Or does the fact that it's a one-party system and authoritarians don't necessarily have to be afraid of being ousted because there's an economic downturn, I mean, does that just give them an advantage there?
Well, yes, I think it does. We're heading into a presidential election in 2020. They're not. So I do think it does. I also think that for historical and cultural reasons, they're not going to be bullied by us. And so bullying was probably the worst tactic to take when you want people to change their behavior. And those people are people who are already sensitive to foreign encroachment. So I do think they have the advantage, even if we are able to inflict more pain on them than they are on us. I definitely think they'll take pain over capitulation. And it's important, I think, to step back and say, think about what we're saying. We're saying that the United States of America's foreign policy toward a sovereign country is to try to destroy their economy. Really? That's where we are? And I think that every other country in the world is looking at that and thinking, do I really want to start bilateral negotiations with the United States right now?
Does it seem like at this point that we will reach an agreement with China before the 2020 election?
It's a very, difficult question to ask because you have two strong personalities involved, President Xi Jinping and President Donald Trump. I would guess not. And the reason I would say not is because there really has been very little progress on the underlying issues. The issues that would really have to be addressed for President Trump to claim success in any way that anyone would accept as legitimate. I think he's been trying to paint this picture the way he wants the American public to see it. So he repeats often the statement that it's the Chinese who are paying for the tariffs, not to the Americans. But I think Americans day by day believe that less and less. They see the farmers suffering. We've seen study after study show that import prices are going up, that the tariff revenues that are coming into the U.S. Treasury are being paid for by higher prices for U.S. companies and U.S. consumers. So I think that if he were to reach an agreement, it would be very carefully scrutinized, and it would have to really address these underlying issues on which they've made no progress. That does not make me very hopeful for a successful outcome.
At the beginning of the month, Trump announced a 10% tariff on the remaining $300 billion of Chinese goods that weren't already being taxed, and that was supposed to start on September 1st. And then earlier this week, he said that he was going to delay some of those tariffs until mid-December after stores have stocked up for holiday shopping. I mean, is that essentially an acknowledgement that the tariffs are hurting Americans' wallets and also some indication that Trump may just back off if his tariffs start to hurt the markets too much?
Well, that's two questions. So let's take the first. The answer is yes. It clearly is an acknowledgement that some of the tariff is passed through to American consumers. There really is no other way to paint it. And, economists have been saying this for a long time. And as I said, we have very solid studies looking at import prices and import volumes to show what's happening at the border. So it is. He said it's the Chinese that are paying, but it's clearly not. I have long believed that that last bunch of products would be a bridge too far for President Trump because of the products that were included, most of which now have been delayed until December.
And that's consumer electronics, right?
It is. Yes. It is also, there are certain apparel, footwear in both the set of goods that are going to be taxed in September and the set that are going to be taxed in December. But yeah, clearly the big money is in laptops and iPhones. And so, yeah, it's and game consoles, a lot of things that end up under the Christmas tree, and they're big ticket items for families. So, yeah, I think that was clearly an admission. It was just almost, it was too far. And, you have to juxtapose that with, what are we getting? So people who support the president's approach often say, but we just have to stay the course. We're going to get something. Well, the longer we don't get anything, quote unquote, the harder it is to make that case because, you know, we see bankruptcies increasing in farm country in the Midwest. You know, we see consumers paying more and ratcheting up that pain without any success on the negotiating front, I think, was very bad for him politically. We'll see if he actually does go ahead with those tariffs in December.
The president obviously pays plenty of attention to the markets. We know from, you know, watching his Twitter feed. Does it seem like market pressure is something that would convince Trump to reverse course at this point? I know I'm asking you to like read a crystal ball here, but what are economists saying about the circumstances under which Trump reverses course on tariffs?
It's very hard to say. I mean, he is a, you know, people have pointed out he's been very consistent in his views on the trade deficit, which has been getting worse. He's surrounded himself with true believers like Peter Navarro, who, you know, basically is a man of one. No one basically shares his, very few people share his views on economics and international economics. So, and he himself has called himself a tariff man. He loves tariffs. But he's increasingly becoming a one-trick pony. He has tariffs. He has this stick, and he keeps hitting people with the stick. And people are going to start asking, okay, beyond watching you hit people with a stick, which might be sort of fun for a while, what is going to happen next? And I think it would be the market that would discipline that. I think that does seem to have a big impact on his psyche. Surprisingly, the market is almost seems largely short-term driven. So we see it go up and down. So yesterday it went up with the announcement of the delay. It's headed down today, I believe. So, you know, longer term, what's going to happen? Longer term, we will see the economy weakening. We will see this continual disruption and uncertainty undue business investment, and ultimately the consumer spending is driving the economy, and then the market will soften. And I think he will either not win the election or he'll have to come up with some different approach.
And of course, for listeners, we are recording this on Wednesday, so references to yesterday were Tuesday when the market rose on the news that Trump would delay the tariffs, and today means Wednesday when the Dow fell significantly. The other issue here from reporting that I've read about the Trump administration is that the tariffs are not just about getting China to come to the table and make concessions when it comes to the concerns that, you know, lawmakers have across both parties. It's also a concerted effort to decouple the two economies. So in a sense, the tariffs would be here to stay because the goal of the Trump administration is to make the United States less reliant on China and, you know, enhance its trade relationships with other countries apart from China. Does that seem like what's going on?
Oh, it's definitely true that there are people in the administration and people in Congress who share that view. That is clearly not the legal basis for the tariffs that was, technically under this Section 301 case. So this is extracurricular.
Is that happening, though, at this point? Are the economies decoupling?
Yes, I think as businesses see that this type of conflict will continue or could possibly continue, there are movements of firms either out of China into new or just looking for new subcontractors. So, you know, let's say that you are designing shoes and you look for subcontractors and you can change from season to season and they'll change. They'll move to different places. These labor intensive items like apparel and footwear and toys and sporting goods were already moving to some extent. China's wages have been rising for 20 years. So we saw particularly Vietnam come on strong as a location for footwear and apparel. So the movement was already underway, and this clearly has been accelerating it. Some of the factories that are opening up in Vietnam are, in fact, Chinese-owned. They're moving production offshore to serve the American market. Now, notice that we're the only country that's doing this. So the Chinese don't have to move production to serve France or to serve Russia or sub-Saharan Africa or, you know, wherever they want. So it's just us, and we will pay higher prices as a result, where the rest of the world will not. And that is a competitive disadvantage for American companies, because the majority of things that we import from China are either capital goods, so machines that businesses would use, or their input. So they're things like an electric motor that goes into a boat, a fishing boat. Of course, you know, for the everyday person, when we think about imports from China, you know, we think about clothes and soccer balls and iPhones. But in fact, this is a huge amount of goods that we're importing every year from China. And the biggest part of it is in these goods that our producers use. And so we're raising the cost for them. And that's going to make it harder for our producers to compete with foreign goods that are sold here in our market, so say European-made products, or to compete against those European firms in third markets. So yes, the movement is happening, but it's only for the United States, and therefore it's a competitive disadvantage for us.
Trade has become somewhat of a tricky subject for the two parties. I think for a couple decades, basically, the two parties accepted that free trade was the name of the game, and both Republicans and Democrats were involved in pursuing free trade agreements. Of course, Trump does not seem to be hot on free trade. And we also saw during the 2016 primary on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders was not particularly hot on free trade. And even Hillary Clinton eventually said that she was not interested in pursuing the TPP if elected. I want to focus a little bit on the Democratic side here. What, at this point, does it look like the Democratic Party's philosophy is on trade?
Well, we're going to have to hear more from the candidates. You know, to her credit, Elizabeth Warren has presented a plan, which is fairly detailed, and which would include holding other countries to higher standards than we ourselves hold to engage in free trade negotiations with us. So very high standards for environment and labor, which we at this point don't meet. So we know that her plan is one that would say we have high standards. We'd have to raise our own standards here before we could implement her plan. But it's not a particularly trade-friendly one. It's meant to be worker-friendly. So there is this basic underlying tension that trade is not worker-friendly. I think we have lots of evidence that trade can be worker-friendly. I think we know that our workers are going to face lots of changes over the next couple of decades. Not just trade. In fact, probably trade will be the lesser of the problem. You know, when we look back at the last 30 years, we have to say, wow, we absorbed China into the global economy. And that's huge, right? It's more than 1 billion people in an economy that was growing extremely rapidly. That's not going to continue. China's labor force has basically stopped growing. And what we're going to see is China trying to move up into other, you know, products that we would think we have an advantage in. That's what we have to deal with. At the same time, it's going to be very rapid technological change. Well, American workers need a strategy to weather that. And I don't think that tariffs or saying that we're not going to do a trade agreement with India because it doesn't have high enough environmental standards is really going to meet it. So I think that you are correct in saying that, you know, trade, freer trade or trade negotiations or working with other nations is not actually high on either party's list right now. But unfortunately, you know, I think that's going to be to the detriment of the American worker.
Something that Trump has articulated and Democrats as well has been an interest in making things in the United States again. Is that a reasonable pursuit at this point? Is that something that either party could accomplish?
You know, when they say that, it sounds nice. But what does it mean? And where's the strategy? I mean, I grew up in Rhode Island. And, you know, one thing about Rhode Island, a very open state. And it was a state that was very dependent on textiles and apparel. And believe it or not, things like rubber bands, elastic, foam rubber. I had an aunt who worked in a foam rubber mill. So, you know, when I was a little girl, I do remember this, and the factories went away. They moved to the South. Is anybody raising their children to do that kind of work? The answer probably is no. And if we did, they could not earn a wage that was in any way a living wage. So what we need to say is, how can we create jobs that provide living wages for American workers? And, you know, sewing T-shirts and creating, you know, foam rubber pillows is just really not the future for our kids. So how do we do that? We're not having, you know, what does it mean made in America? What kind of things do you want to make? How do you make this the best place to make it? There's a whole wide world out there. The U.S. is a big part, but an ever-decreasing part. And, you know, these things are not coming back. We have to look to the future. We have to think about how our economy is evolving and how we work hand in hand with the private sector to make sure that our workers are ready to engage in those activities.
And so what does the future of American work look like?
Well, it's going to be one that's going to be heavily capital intensive. So you're going to have fewer workers in a factory that has high productivity. In fact, that has been the story of American manufacturing. Yes, you can look at graphs showing that the number of people employed in manufacturing has declined, and yet the share of manufacturing in the overall economy has not. How has that happened? Well, just like in agriculture did, you know, 100 years ago, we produce more with fewer workers. So that will continue. We have to be a place where it's great to make capital investments. I think that's what we've been trying to do. Unfortunately, we have to make sure that some of those gains are shared widely in the sense of being returned to people and good infrastructure, improvements in education. And I think in the United States, you can get the best education in the world, but you also have tremendous heterogeneity. You have school districts who clearly don't have the basics that they need. So we really have to address the inequality that we have. And that's going to require money. And capital as well as labor are going to have to provide the tax revenue to do that. No one is going to campaign on that, I'm afraid. But what we need is investment in American workers and American infrastructure, and make sure that we have clear rules and that we make it easy for businesses to do business here. So it's a tall order. You have to make sure that workers have the resources that they need, which means the government has to have the resources that it needs to provide transition assistance for workers and training from, you know, cradle to grave, while still making this a very hospitable place for capital. You know, the truth is the United States is a very attractive place for capital. We don't have trouble attracting capital. Right now, interest rates are ridiculously low. So getting capital, there's a world capital glut. So what we need to do is think about how do we use that capital in a way that really benefits people.
All right. Well, I think that's it for now. We've covered a lot of ground. I've enjoyed learning a bit about trade and American work. So thank you so much for joining me today, Mary.
Oh, thanks, Galen.
Mary Lovely is an international economist at Syracuse University, and she's also a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics. My name is Galen Druk. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.